Hello and welcome to Databook, a podcast presented by Chief Healthcare Executive. I'm Ron Southwick, Senior Editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. With Databook, we talk to healthcare leaders about technology, innovation, and the transformation of healthcare. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll get started in just a moment. We have a very special conversation today. We're talking with Arthi Mesterzo, the Chief Medical Officer of CCS. She's a physician with a great deal of experience as a healthcare executive, but she's gained new insights in the industry as a patient. She recently disclosed that she's been diagnosed with breast cancer. Arthi talks about her journey as a patient and the shortcomings of the healthcare system. She talks about ways that technology needs to be designed with more consideration for patients and providers. And she talks about what physicians and executives should know about treating patients. Arthi's very candid and thoughtful, and she brings very valuable perspective. Please join us. Thanks for joining us today. We have a great interview. I think it's going to be a very worthwhile discussion with Arthi Mesterzo, the Chief Medical Officer of CCS, a company that provides clinical programs and home-delivered medical supplies for people with chronic conditions. We're also going to be talking about Dr. Mesterzo's personal journey. So Dr. Mesterzo, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you talk just a little bit about your background before we dive in and your work with CCS?
Thank you for asking. So I am the Chief Medical Officer of CCS. I've been a board certified internal medicine physician for over 20 to 5 years now. Spent most of my professional journey in advanced wound care and then got into the business side of things through a private equity company that I had joined. Where I led medical affairs, and just really kind of fell in love with the business side of medicine and ended up starting my own business here in Cincinnati. So that to private equity. I've had various roles, mostly in private equity businesses, healthcare services, running product development, innovation, physician practice, P&L, spent some time in medical device as well, doing a lot of sales and marketing type of work. And then spent a couple of years at one of the largest payers in the country at Humana for 2 years, and then joined CCS. And I joined CCS less than a year ago because one of the things that I'm really passionate about is, number one, value-based care, right? Doing the right thing for people for the right reasons. But what I loved about the opportunity at CCS is this was a almost 30-year established business. Profitable, successful, didn't really have a need to change, right? Because it was doing great as a quote unquote DME company, which we internally see as a bad word because we see ourselves differently. But the CEO, Tony Vahedian, who joined, two and a half years ago, had a vision of doing something much more. And so the reason I joined CCS is because we're taking that trust and engagement that we get with our patients that we ship supplies to now do much more. So it's, you get the supply, but then we hug you with this village of a care solution that helps you with your social determinants of health, helps you with your coaching education, with your diabetes, helps with your CHF, your blood pressure, right? So the whole goal is to surround that patient with a holistic solution, including addressing SDOH, to get them better health outcomes.
There seems to be so much more discussion about the social determinants of health now. It's a welcome conversation. What are some key things that, you know, health systems, payers can be doing to start meeting patients' needs beyond medicine?
So we do some of that today, Ron. The problem is that here's what I've noticed as a patient is that it's a lot of check the box actions. It's not intentional. And we do things, right? Regulatory agencies, JCO, right? All these things that require it. CMS requires it, right? There are Medicare Advantage plans that have regulatory requirements. The question is we can ask those SDOH questions and check the box and say we did it. But unless there's actually a movement behind it, a solution, a push to actually address it, it really does become a check the box action. And so what can we do? I think it's number one, understanding why it's so important. I think we talk about it, but nobody's been able to truly quantify it. We all inherently know that loneliness is an issue, there was just an article that just came out. I was about to open it and read it this morning about the impact of loneliness on health outcomes. It's a huge issue. Transportation, food insecurity. At CCS, we surveyed our 150,000 plus folks, and the responders, of thousands of folks that responded, 11% of them said that they had food insecurity. And of those, over 30 to 35% of them are Medicaid. So it's our responsibility, everyone, right? Including us as CCS. We've got to do a better job. You cannot possibly have advanced diabetes on insulin, but then not be able to afford the foods that you need. It doesn't make any sense to me. Transportation is a huge one. We didn't see that in our patient population at CCS, but at Humana and in other surveys that we've done, it was a huge problem. And so how do you make sure that those patients can come into clinic? I mean, how do you get healthcare if you can't come into clinic? And the reality is, if you can't afford transportation, you probably also don't have good Wi-Fi and a computer that works. So don't tell me telehealth's the solution, right? So I think coming to the table with a holistic solution is really important. And the reason I feel so passionate about it, even before becoming a patient, Ron, is I grew up in a village in India where my grandfather was the doctor for 1,000 people in this little village. And he got paid in vegetables sometimes. But that man had a car, and he would go to people's houses if they couldn't come to you. And it's just, I feel like we've lost that heart of healthcare. We've forgotten the big picture. And SDOH to me is like the elephant in the room, which is like, if you can't fix this, if you can't fix loneliness, you've got depressed people. They're not getting out of bed thinking, yay, I'm going to take my meds today and exercise and eat healthy. They're too sad and lonely. These just simple things like that, that I just think we, as a Western society, underestimate.
You mentioned your own journey as a patient. Recently you disclosed that you've been diagnosed with breast cancer, which was, I'm sure, very meaningful to see somebody openly share their journey that way. What led you to want to come forward and to share what you're going through?
Well, one of the reasons was practical, right? I'm going to do video interviews like this, and people are going to say, why did she shave her head? And people are going to ask questions. I'm going to start going to conferences on October after I finish surgery and radiation. I'll be out there and they're going to say, what is going on? And I didn't want to repeat the story 1,000 times to my professional network. So there is obviously practical reason, which is just don't hide it, just share it, own it. Then the second and most prominent reason truly is I got into healthcare because I believe that of all the career paths you can choose, helping people in their most vulnerable state, helping them get healthier when they come to you requesting for healthcare, is one of the most noble things that you can do with your life. I come from a family of physicians and it's in my blood. And I thought to myself, how can this help people? I know this sounds a little Pollyanna, but I kind of sat on it and I thought, what do I do with this information? And I wanted to share it. And I wanted to share it because here I am, a person who eats mostly organic food, cooks at home, has access to good healthcare, has zero risk factors for breast cancer, and I got it. So if I got it, that means you need to get screened. My own sister had not had a mammogram. She's older than me in a few years. And she said, well, I didn't know I needed it because I didn't have any risk factors. I said, guess what? Now you do. Run and get your mammo. So the number of folks that reached out on LinkedIn afterwards who DM'd me and said, thank you so much. I was going to skip mine this year. Thank you so much. I haven't had one ever. I think in itself, to me, promoting healthcare.
You talked about the practical aspects of it. What are some things you're learning as you're a patient now that you probably knew intellectually on many levels, and maybe even emotionally as well, but now that you're undergoing through these things as a patient, are there things you're learning as a patient that are more clear now than maybe a few months ago?
Yeah, I don't think we have enough time on this podcast to list it all out, but I would tell you, Ron, that it's been truly transformational for someone who bleeds healthcare and really wants value-based care, for someone who wants healthcare to change for the better. you know, sometimes things happen for a reason. I needed this insight. Mm-hmm. And this insight has truly changed me as a person, professionally and personally. And I would say from a healthcare executive standpoint, I would sum it up as it is really scary to be a patient. It is, the care is extremely siloed. The incentives are not aligned for my best health. The people doing the work are burned out, exhausted. And there is, no one's reaching across the table from payer and provider, health system, patient, all the other supporting ancillary things that you need. There's no connection. What there is a fancy EMR. There is an app that gives me data results before my doctor sees them, which is, by the way, very scary if you're not a doctor. I learned that I had cancer before my doctor did. So if that tells you something, I'm a physician, so I can process this, right? How does someone who doesn't have a medical background or doesn't have an advocate with them get through this? I can't tell you the number of times that mistakes were made that seem minor, but when they all come together, could have had a major impact if I didn't have the care that I had, plus my insight into the medical care, right? Is being able to say, wait a minute, I'll give you an example. The EMR chart had me at 6'7" instead of 5'7" and 40 pounds over than what my weight is. Now, not a big deal. Who cares if I'm 6'7"? Well, it is a big deal when I go in for surgery, when I get any medication that is designed for my weight and my height. And these mistakes happen in pediatric medicine all the time. So it's not, I don't want to blame the EMR. What I'm saying is that we are all doing one-off care when we do healthcare. It is not a well-orchestrated thing as it should be. And the quarterback, the person who really should be quarterbacking, isn't really connected to all the other things that are happening, isn't paid to be connected to all the things that are happening because it's a fee-for-service world. And we just can't, this doesn't work. This doesn't work.
When you talked about seeing your diagnosis on your app, I guess before your doctor,
yeah,
it just made me think, like, I was, you know, checked out something very minor, turned out to be no big deal, like calf injury. My doctor said, you know, I'm sure it's nothing, but let's just make sure there's not a blood clot here. So they checked it and fine. And I was able to see them the other way. And thought, that's great. I can see this right away. I'm not waiting 3 days and wondering.
Yeah.
But even then it hit me. But if this was something more serious, I'm not sure I'd want to see this till the doctor told me.
Thank you.
Are we getting to a point where we're getting ahead of ourselves too much? And maybe some things don't need to be seen, right? Or you need the doctor to be sharing this with. I can't imagine seeing that on the app and, like, you know, whether you're trying to be a doctor or not.
Yeah. I got my ultrasound result almost immediately, right? It shows up on my chart. Ding, you have a new test result. Lesion, blah, 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 o'clock, suspected carcinoma, recommend biopsy. Okay, I know what that means. What does that mean to someone who's not a physician? It's scary. This is ridiculous. And I think it happens because, I mean, this was a result, this data sharing is part of, you know, a lot of the legislation, right, that have been passed over the past 10 years. And the problem with regulatory things like that is it's sort of a sledgehammer and it's a wide swing. And the intentions are good, but then the results, you don't have. And I almost wonder sometimes, Ron, do we have physicians at the table making these decisions, or are they attorneys and policymakers? How many doctors and nurses were at the table to say, ooh, that's not a good idea? Mm-hmm.
It makes you wonder. I just was thinking back to my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2009.
I'm sorry to hear that.
A rough year and a half. She's doing great now, like, you know, 13, 14 years later, she's healthy and she's doing great. We lucked out in a big way with her oncologist was really just not only just a brilliant doctor, but he really got the human side. I mean, he was very, never rushed in the exams, always, you know, asked, do you have any questions? Do you have any other questions? He kept saying, like, I'm not leaving till I've answered all your questions. I mean, we lucked out in a big way with that. In your experience, are you finding the empathy you need from, you know, the doctors, the nurses? I mean, from your perspective, are you getting the support you need, not just in terms of the diagnosis, but the human side?
So it's an unfair question for me because I'm getting what I would consider VIP care. And the reason I consider it VIP care is my doctor was my chief resident when I was an internist. The person who put in my port is a friend of mine. The hospital that I'm going to is the hospital that I practiced at and built wound care centers at and had administrative roles at. So I would say that I'm getting the empathy from the folks that are directly providing the care. The nurses have been amazing. And I always have this saying, I want to get a t-shirt that says nurses are angels. I have to tell you, I love doctors, but man, when nurses say they're burned out, we need to pay attention because those are the people that are actually truly taking care of you. Here's where I would say is a miss. When I went in for my first appointment to the breast surgeon, I got a folder, you know, this big, right? It had all the resources. And here's a cancer support group, and they meet on this, and here's this, and here's this, and here's the number that you can call if you need somebody to come clean your house. Here's the number that you can call if you need help with food. Here are all the community resources, right? And then you get phone calls from folks saying, hey, we're silver ribbon or pink ribbon support group here, and we can do this. And at the time, I was so overwhelmed, Ron, with the diagnosis that getting an onslaught, getting a folder of all that information, and those phone calls coming in the first week or two, it was overwhelming. It was just too much. When I needed it, when I truly need it, is after things calm down and the phone calls stop. So this is the time, right? When you're midway through chemotherapy, when you've lost your hair, when you feel really, really, really bad. And I have had really bad days, and you can imagine your wife went through it. That's when I need the support group. That's when I need the phone calls. But by then, I don't remember who called me. In hindsight, I could have written down all the phone numbers and what they were offering me and all of that, but my state of mind wasn't there. Now I have a folder that says, hey, you can attend this group, but that group meets once a month and it isn't meeting for another 3 weeks. What I need is help today. Like today, I feel bad. I feel sad. I need somebody to reassure me that I'm going to be okay. I don't know who to call. That to me is a miss because people don't have crises on schedules, right? I'm not, by when the cancer support group meets in 3 weeks, I may not be on the same emotional roller coaster then that I am now because I just got chemo and I feel like I'd rather die right now because it feels so, so, so bad. That's when I need somebody. So it's, like I said before, I think the intentions are there, the programs are there, but have we thought about it through the patient lens? And I think that's the miss, is all the definitions that we make. What is value-based care? What is like SDOH? We design these things outside looking in. We should be designing them inside out. We need to have more patients at the table. We should not have passed regulations on, hey, here's my chart app that's going to give me all my information. We should have probably asked patients, what information do you want and how? And we didn't. We just do stuff to people. We don't do it for people. It's very frustrating.
You've mentioned the burnout that doctors and nurses have been dealing with, especially, I mean, doctors and nurses have always faced demanding jobs, but after 3 years of the pandemic and after labor shortages and just so much time putting out fires, I can't imagine how burned out some of these folks are. Does it feel like health systems are recognizing the level of the burnout on their clinicians and taking some steps to deal with that? Or is that something that still is not really fully being grasped?
I would say some health systems are and some aren't. Cincinnati's a great city, right? There's Mark Twain has a saying, you know, if the world's ending, I'm moving to Cincinnati because it's 30 years behind. So I think my community here is recognizing it. They're taking steps. They're not quite there yet, but they know that the problem exists, which is step one, right? In terms of how you solve for it, it's a difficult problem because the financial model hasn't really changed. There's still physicians working on RVUs. There are still physicians that have EMR documentation requirements and all the other administrative duties that they have. So the problem is being recognized, but the way to fix it isn't support groups. The way to fix it isn't a hotline to call when you're having, you know, mental health issues. The way to fix it is to fix the things that are causing the burnout in the first place. And the things that are causing the burnout in the first place are there because of the way the system works and because of the way the compensation and the operations of it works. And to fix that overnight is really, really hard because the compensation model is not aligned with that. And so I would say that the systems that are doing it well are the ones that are embracing more value-based care types of strategies that aren't fee-for-service, right? That have a better network, of subspecialists and other ancillary providers that make things easier for the physicians to navigate. But something has to be done. We have lost, we keep putting more and more on these doctors as opposed to taking away stuff. And I have yet to meet a physician who went through medical school thinking, I'm going to cheat the system. I'm going to provide substandard care and just make a ton of money. We didn't go to med school for that, right? Like, we went to med school because we wanted, even if people say, oh, well, they're really money-minded, they're financially driven practice, even those practices, nobody is there wanting to provide substandard care. Everybody wants to be a rock star. Doctors are highly competitive people and they want to know that they're the best doctor that they can be. So let them be that. Let's remove all the other stuff and just let them be really, really excellent doctors, because that's what they want.
What would you like other doctors to be thinking about? I'm glad you're getting the good VIP experiences you described it in your journey, but what would you like doctors to be thinking about when they're treating a patient with cancer or another serious illness?
Yeah, I would say it as simply as this, is put yourself in the patient's shoes. What do they want? Here's what I want. It's simple. Number one, are the things that you're doing to me or for me on behalf of my health, are you doing it for the right reasons? Please ask yourself that. And number two, do you feel empowered, enabled, supported, and motivated to do what's right by me? Just put yourself in my shoes. My father, when I graduated medical school, gave me a few pieces of advice, three of them, but one of them, he said, when people come to you for healthcare, they are at their most vulnerable, regardless of status, money, education. They are at their most vulnerable. Steve Jobs, when he had cancer, was at his most vulnerable. There are certain things money cannot buy and status cannot buy. Don't ever take your role in that for granted. When people come to you, they're at your most vulnerable. Don't ever do anything to them that you wouldn't do to me or your mom. And that's just one of those ethos that I've always lived by. I've transferred it to my corporate roles as well, right? About respect and how you practice as an executive leader and what it means to be a leader in an executive corporate role. They're one and the same. It's about doing the right thing for people.
You talked about, like, you know, people being at their most vulnerable. It reminded me of, I was really glad when my wife was diagnosed, her doctor had said, really stressed like that, I should be at every appointment if at all possible. Yeah. Because that's when especially she's going through chemo, she's getting foggy. She's like, she needs somebody to help remember things and take down the notes, or maybe bring up something that she might forget or stuff like that. So it just makes me think that, you know, in that situation, you have to make some tough decisions and you're nowhere near your best. So that's one of those things I think sometimes providers need to think about is as they're walking people through this, like, helping people make a good decision when they're not in the business to make the best decision.
Yeah. And it's, You're absolutely right. And that is the bedside manner, right? It's the ability to spend that time to clearly articulate what this means. What are your options? What do those options mean? And then what is my recommendation to you as a doctor for your best health outcome? I think one of the things that's really tricky as a physician becoming a patient is sometimes you don't get treated like the patient, right? They assume. And so one of the things that I've gotten the habit of doing is saying, I'm a physician. However, in this room, just treat me like a patient. Just talk to me like you would if somebody hadn't gone through medical school, and help me understand this. Because when you're a physician or a nurse, right, if you're a clinician, other clinicians assume that you kind of know some of this stuff and they skip over it. So I'm glad you went to those appointments. I had, I made the mistake of going to one appointment by myself because I was so eager to get in. I didn't wait even a day so my husband could join, and I regret it. He should have been there because he's my note taker. But what I would go back to you, Ron, and say, what happens when people don't have an advocate? A lot of people live alone. A lot of people don't have family support. And let's not confuse poverty with loneliness and support, right? When we think about, you brought up SDOH earlier, and we think about social determinants of health and loneliness and all these things. And listen, there are a lot of folks that can afford food yet don't have an advocate in their home or someone that can come to every appointment. I know, because I've practiced for, you know, almost 20 years, and people come alone to these appointments, and I'm thinking, where is somebody here to help you?
As a patient, what's the most frustrating aspect of this in terms of just not just the disease itself, but that even sometimes people who say something that's well-intentioned, but just really the worst thing to say at that possible moment? Is it just, like you said, just the, you know, not being able to access some of those resources at a time when you need it? I mean, what's the most frustrating aspect of this for you?
So I'll split it up in two, in my personal life, right, versus the life as a patient. The life as a patient, one of the most frustrating, and I would say today, maybe last week it would have been a different answer, but I would say today the biggest frustration is lack of communication between all the different providers that are surrounding me. I've got a radiation oncology appointment. I've got chemo coming up this Thursday. I've got an internal medicine physician. I've got so many doctors. I went from having one primary care physician to now having, I don't know how many people I see. Nobody talks to each other. There's no coordination. It's very, very frustrating. And I can't, now I see why so many mistakes are made because these folks don't communicate. They're not even on the same EMR. It's ridiculous. Personally, well-meaning, God, that's a great question. I would say that things go in a similar order for me. They want to know what diagnosis, and then the questions are really about, why did you get it? And the why did you get it is really internally and psychologically, I can understand this, is those questions are designed to, am I at risk? Right. So, oh, what kind of risk factors do you have? Did you have a BRCA gene? Did your mom have it? Right. Because they want to understand, why do you have it? Because maybe I could have it. Right. So those questions, again, well-meaning. And I think then it comes, those questions then to, so how are you feeling? Well, I'm feeling good, but I had a few days there after chemo where it really, really, really felt really bad. And I feel scared, because I'm about to have a surgery. Oh, and after that, I'm about to have radiation. And as a wound care doctor, I kind of know what all the complications of that can be. So I'm scared. But you don't share that 50,000 times over and over again, right? And then the conversation then goes to how great you look. And usually it's topped off with a, man, you look really good bald. You pull it off really, really well. So these are all, I think it's part of human nature, Ron. And I've gotten used to it, and I've figured it out, and I've realized that it's all coming from a great place of caring and a place of love. But as a patient, when you see the same cycle, you almost have to come, and I'm curious to see how your wife handled it. but I've had to come up with a canned response to help navigate all of those questions that I know now to anticipate in one short sentence.
Yeah, it's yeah, and my I think my wife did similar things in terms of, I mean, there's the closer friends and family who she could really say, yeah, I've had an awful day, or it's been an awful week. But there's a lot of, you know, people that, you know, she would just kind of have to do the sort of like, you know, we're hanging in and doing the best.
Yeah.
We, you know, I think the one thing that she said could get frustrating sometimes, and I saw that Julie Louis-Dreyfus actually mentioned this in an interview when she was talking about her breast cancer battle. She mentioned like, you know, let me know what people would say. Let me know what I can do. Let me know what can help, which was like, okay, but that's another burden on me. I mean, if you want to drop off a meal, great, drop off a meal. If you want to just check in or pop in, check in, but don't ask me to think of what you can do. It's like, I don't need extra. It came from a well-meaning place, and I'm sure people are sincere, but sometimes, I don't know, do whatever.
Yeah. It's the worst question. Let me know what I can do. I can't. I don't know. What I love, and this is maybe just, you know, as this podcast gets out there, what I find better is I have friends who will reach out and say, I want to do something for you this week. Here are my options. Here are the things. Do any of these sound good to you? It's just more actionable. So this weekend, a friend reached out and said, I'm free every night this week. I'd like to do a dinner and a movie or a walk. Any of them sound good? I can also just drop off food. What would you like? Much better.
It takes the decision making off you, because you don't need another decision to make right now. And and it's something concrete where it's like, maybe it's the meal, maybe it's like, hey,
yeah,
movie where I'm not thinking about things.
yes,
wonderful.
And what I've been able to, one of the things I learned personally through this cancer journey is the self-awareness meter, Ron. I've always been on a journey of self-awareness and development. I would say that it's reached an all-time high in terms of really connecting deeply with what do I need as a person? What do I value? What's the most important thing to me? And what's odd is you would think that what I needed was meals and things. What I really crave and what I realize about myself is I want connection. So when people say, what do you need? They say, I just want to visit. Just come and visit. Have a cup of coffee with me. Because really what I want to do is just talk. Not about cancer. I just want connection. So the beauty in a diagnosis like this is that once I switched my mindset to this cancer is happening for me, it's opened up all of these possibilities of what does this mean to me professionally, personally, in terms of development? How do I articulate it? And it's gotten much easier to be able to articulate what my needs are.
Well, any other last messages for patients you'd like them to think about who are going through the similar?
Yeah, I would, well, for those who are not patients, I would say just please, please, please don't skip your cancer screenings. I was this close to not getting my mammogram this year because I had a normal one and thought I'm not at risk. So don't skip your cancer screenings. And then for those who are patients, I would say advocate for yourself. Don't worry about being called the high maintenance person. This is about you, and you've got to take care of yourself and advocate for yourself because the system is broken. These are well-intentioned clinicians doing their best, nurses and doctors, to try to take care of you, but the system is not designed for that. And so advocate for yourself. Take somebody with you to your appointments. If you don't have someone in your home, reach out to local communities. Right? Get involved with the church, get involved with local groups, whatever it takes, but make sure you get somebody to help you through the journey. And then lastly, if there's something that I've learned is the appreciation for preventative health. As a physician, I've had weight gain, right? I've had weight loss. I've spent a lot of my adult time heavier than I should be, eating the wrong foods that I should have known better. And I would just say that food is medicine. And so one thing that you can control is what you put in your body, and take care of your health.
Well, thank you very much for sharing these thoughts. I really appreciate the conversation.
Thank you for having me. This is great. I appreciate you having me on. This is fun. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you for joining Databook, a podcast presented by Chief Healthcare Executive, a brand of MGH Life Sciences. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. For the latest news, analysis, and insights on healthcare, visit our website, chiefhealthcareexecutive.com. You can follow us on social media on LinkedIn and Twitter. I'm Ron Southwick, Senior Editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. Thanks again for joining us. Take care.